You are listening to WPVM LP Asheville, 103.5, the progressive voice of the mountains. My name is Josh Jordan. You're listening to Pathways to the Sacred, and our guest today is Reverend Marcia McLean. She's the co-founder and spiritual leader of the Wisdom Center in Black Mountain. And we've been having a discussion about the science of mind, part of the new thought movement that started beginning of the 20th century. Marcia, there are a couple spiritual practices that have the word science in the title, like Scientology and the Christian Scientists, and also the science of mind. Is science of mind similar or different to these?
I think I'll answer the Scientology question first, since it's been in the media a lot lately. I have to say that probably just as much as people speak about science of mind not necessarily understanding it, I could do the same and not do justice to Scientology. However, my understanding is that, one, that is a newer philosophy, and two, that there is a financial investment involved in gaining access to what it is that they teach, and a greater investment depending on the level that one desires to achieve. Science of mind is something that is offered on a love offering basis, or sometimes classes on a very, very reasonable basis. It is not exclusive. It is shared openly and willingly. And Ernest Holmes wanted to be sure that it was left, quote, open at the top, unquote, so that it would always be an ever evolving philosophy as time went on.
Is there science in science of mind? I mean, when I think of science, I think of chemistry and biology and all those classes that I didn't do so well in high school, frankly. What's the science in science of mind? What is that about?
First of all, what it's described as in its original form is a study of laws which are universal, physical laws, for example. Or the simple idea that what one puts out, one gets back, usually multiplied. That what we think about and focus upon energetically is increased by our attention. We're fortunate that today newer studies in quantum physics and newer discoveries that we have been privy to, even in the movie theaters of late, show us that what we look for when we look into the universe determines what we see. So actually the quality of our observation affects what comes out of that. It affects what comes out of that. Basically, that's my answer.
Yeah, that's interesting, because you're right. There have been a lot of films coming out now. I mean, you know, the first one that I became aware of was The Matrix, you know, primarily an action film, but based on the idea that the life we're living is really an illusion, because that's what we've been programmed to observe. But also what the bleep do we know that just came out, dealing with the really hard quantum physics of the universe. And
right, in neurochemistry, all kinds of things. One of the main tenets of science of mind is that it is done unto you as you believe, and that is a Christian teaching. Mm-hmm. However, there are other philosophers and master teachers throughout the ages who have said the same thing, and now quantum physics is saying you're right.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting, because it is in the Bible, as above, so below. But it's certainly not exclusive to Christianity or the Bible, the idea that what you put out is what you get back.
Not
and like you said, oftentimes multiplied.
Right. Right. Yeah. That can work either way. And another part of the, quote, science of mind is understanding how these laws work and using them constructively and consciously to good end.
The website that I was on suggests that And also, I'm sorry, not the website, but Dr. Holmes's book talks about clairvoyance and mediumship. Are these sort of central parts of the Science of Mind practice or philosophy?
Actually, no. In the 1926 textbook, I believe that Ernest Holmes felt it necessary to give attention to some of those topics because there were a lot of things going on in that time, and there still are today, explorations into the paranormal, for example. I believe that he gave a fair examination to those just to honor that these other manifestations of spirit and matter and the relationship between those do exist. And there are some people who are more open or attuned to one way or another. However, every bit of this philosophy says you will find your own answers within you, and you needn't make anyone else your God or your master.
Interesting. Interesting. That suggests, and it's something that, you know, I kind of came across the idea in the materials that I was looking at about Science of Mind, that this world, this physical world, and us as individual human beings, I mean, first of all, the whole concept of individuality being a little bit of a myth, kind of an illusion of the material world that we're in, but that we are incarnations of the spirit. Would that be a fair way of putting it?
Yeah, and I think a good way to clarify that is that each of us is akin to either a drop of water or a wave in relationship to the entire ocean. Hmm. A wave is a good example because it's made of all of the same stuff and essentially and elementally the same, and yet it isn't the whole ocean. It is a temporary experience of individuality in something much greater.
That's interesting. That's something that I've heard before, an analogy of us being individual drops that make up the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
It's so hard to see those sometimes because I don't, you know, I met you for the first time today. When our interview is over, you'll drive off in your car, I'll drive off in mine. We don't kind of flow and move together the way that the waves on the ocean do. And, you know, somebody is doing something that I would choose not to do because of, you know, what I believe is right and wrong as opposed to what they believe is right and wrong. I mean, we seem to be, you know, how do we... How can we reconcile that to the idea that we are all actually part of one whole thing moving together?
I think probably the biggest answer is that the more that we recognize our oneness in all that is, and I know that sounds a little nebulous or trite, when we focus, when we're willing to focus on what we have in common, we begin to see our oneness. We begin to see that no matter what the color of our skin is or our philosophy, that we do share a great deal in common. And I think the willingness to focus on that allows us to feel and experience unity much more than diversity or conflict.
Does one have to... I'm trying to think of the right words for this. Does one have to kind of transcend beyond the material world? I mean, you gave the definition of metaphysical as beyond the physical. Do we need to transcend the physical in order to, I don't want to say become enlightened, but to find ourselves in greater connection with our original source?
I don't think so. Because I believe that the physical world is made up of, quote, God stuff, that everything is made of the same substance in different energetic patterns or forms, if you will, some of them tangible and some of them not. And my understanding is that the physical world is a result of my thinking and my believing, and therefore it is a part of my experience. It is not who I am. My body is temporary. This life is temporary. And there's something about me that is not temporary, that is timeless. And so I try to tap into that. And yet I'm here for a purpose.
Couldn't some of the things that are in this physical and material world, though, detract us from the path to a greater expanded consciousness, and to a greater connection. I mean, if all the material things in this world are made up of the same God stuff, just in a different collection, you know, in a different concoction than, say, I am, mm-hmm. you know, organized. Then how do they seem to have such power over us and really distract us from the original source?
Well, I guess the classic term is Maya, which is being hypnotized by the physical world and all of these dense ideas that we have collected.
Is that what that means?
That's part of what that means. That's my interpretation of it.
I'm sorry. I'm fascinated. Yeah. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just, you know, there's a George Harrison song right after the Beatles broke up where one of the verses in his song says, "Beware of Maya."
Yes.
And I could never figure out what on earth he meant. I'm sure he didn't mean the Mayan culture, the ancient Mexicans. I'm glad you for clearing that up for me.
Well, you've probably heard the phrase, we are spiritual beings having a human experience.
Yes, yes.
And the trick is we have free will. So we are free to be completely distracted, to believe that we are separate from that which made us, to believe that we don't have an ounce of divinity or wisdom or love in us, to believe that we are lost. I mean, there's so much that we can succumb to and be distracted by, and it will turn us away from the, quote, truth of who we are, and then our experience will reflect that.
As above, so below, or so as within, so without. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
The emphasis on mindfulness that I was seeing in some of the materials that I was looking at, that I was researching, is similar to the basis of Vipassana meditation, which is all about mindfulness. Why is mindfulness important?
Well, first of all, I want to say that the term religious science comes together to indicate what we think about God and how we apply these apparent universal laws or truths constructively. And mindfulness ends up being a necessity. If every thought that I have is followed by a feeling and it sets the creative process in motion, I would be wise to know what I am thinking on a regular basis. Because the other aspect of thought is the subconscious. Subconscious is where my former thoughts are stored as memory, and they are still active in the creative medium, which means things that I thought without my mindful supervision are still active in creating my experience unbeknownst to me.
Right, right. Everything that we do and everything that we say has a consequence, you know, whether that's positive or negative in the world. You know, when I hear the word mindfulness, I feel pressure. You know, I feel an uncomfortable pressure that I have to be consciously aware of absolutely everything that I'm doing for fear of the consequence that might have on somebody else, you know, whether somebody misinterprets what I'm saying or misunderstands my motivation, maybe depending on, you know, what their own conditioning is, but maybe because of the way it's coming out of my mouth or the way I was holding my hands or, you know, the furrow in my eyebrows, you know, something like that. I mean, I hear the word mindfulness and I kind of get nervous thinking that there's a lot there that I need to be conscious of. Is that a fair or unfair way of looking at it?
Well, actually it's a way of looking at it that brings up a core idea. often we are encouraged to look at the motives behind the things that we do. I look very carefully to see what's going on in my subconscious, because I could say I want to be very mindful about what I think and feel and say and do so that my life will turn out well. However, if that is based in an underlying belief and an idea that I am afraid of messing up, that's the dominant belief. So whether we watch our thoughts or our diets or whatever, our language, it has to be done in a spirit of joy. It's magical and it's fun and it produces wonderful results.
Is it possible to move from a core motivation of fear to a core motivation of joy?
There's a wonderful teacher, Edwin Gaines, who said we need to give up our addiction to survival. And once we get over being worried about being approved of, which is actually a primal form of being concerned for our own survival existence, then we can just step out into the world and say, come what may, I'm going to try this on and see what happens for me today. Because so many of us have tried living in fear and doubt and worry, and that hasn't helped at all.
Wow, I would imagine that's a difficult thing to do, to give up our attachment to survival, and to make a huge paradigm shift, what seems, at least to me sitting here, like what would be a huge paradigm shift from a core motivation to another core motivation. Is that a difficult thing to do, or is that?
Well, I'd say that in my case, it's taken some time. I grew up in this culture, and I grew up with my family of origin. I grew up with certain values and concerns. I learned how to worry more when things got bad, and I didn't learn till much later that made them worse. I don't know if I'm answering your question yet.
Oh, no. I mean, yeah, I think you are. I mean, it does take some effort and some time. I mean, definitely some concentrated attention to make that change, to shift your consciousness, essentially.
We have a lot of habits, thinking habits, feeling habits, speaking habits, and physical habits. And those are based in the past.
Yeah. And on us as individuals, you know, on what we experience, because somebody who doesn't experience it the same way will have a completely different reaction.
Right. We're all different points of awareness in infinity. So none of us are going to have it exactly the same way.
Do you find yourself in conflict with the Christian community because of the emphasis away from an outer deity?
I have to answer that question a little bit personally, because I was raised a Unitarian Universalist. So I've had to overcome a prejudice that I inherited growing up about theology and dogma. And it is actually through my study of New Thought and Science of Mind that I discovered the magnificent teachings of Jesus, whom I believe is one person who embodied the Christ energy as an example for the rest of us. Now, you could call that Buddha as well. I do have a conflict with a very literal interpretation, and my sense is that it's not a very expanded awareness, and it gives rise to conflict and division and war.
It's interesting that you say having to overcome the prejudices of a Unitarian Universalist upbringing, because I always thought of them as being about as open and as undogmatic as you could get in a formal religious structure.
Well, the prejudice I had was against dogma, and Unitarian Universalism is an alternative to a dogmatic life.
That's interesting. So that kind of what you're saying kind of suggests to me that there is a place for dogma, that there is a value to that if what you had to do was overcome your prejudice against it.
Well, I believe that I needn't judge anyone unless I want to live in a world in which I'm judged too, where judgment is existing.
Okay, so it has more to do with your own judgment than the dogma itself.
Right. I am a free thinker, and I wouldn't adopt a philosophy that didn't allow that, and I wouldn't teach one that didn't. And my sense is that some of the more literal interpretations of biblical teachings do not encourage a lot of free thinking, although there's still that beautiful message of love thy brother that has stayed in there all along. There are other things that are more liberating to the individual that I don't agree with.
Would you consider the science of mind, would you consider science of mind as a religion and as an organized religion the same way that Catholicism is an organized religion?
The answer, according to Ernest Holmes, is yes, it is. It is a religion. He also refers to it as a philosophy and a way of life, and suggests that no matter what your spiritual background or your chosen religion may be, that you can use the principles outlined in religious science or science of mind as a complement to that. There should be no conflict between them.
Right, right. Let's take this opportunity. We'll go for another station break, and we'll be right back on Pathways to the Sacred. Our guest is Reverend Marcia McLean. My name is Josh Jordan, and we'll be back with you in a couple minutes.
Oh, he said it was the sound of the winter calling. I'm up around the bend, or it could be the cry of your restless heart, or the love of your long lost friend. Oh, but me, I think it's just the summertime and the heat of these Texas winds. They keep on a slapping my face with dust so thick that the tears won't roll again. Last of the true believers, if you grown weary all alone, you could go home. Last of a true believer, you pack your things and go back home. You could go home again, home. Oh, he said you can't stay away forever, cause they say love doesn't last that long, and the ghost of the one that you love the best is bound to be long gone. So you fall for the one you believe in, and take pride in the heart you hold, cause when the wind time pounds upon your door, it's sheltered from the cold. Last of the true believers, if you're grown weary all alone, you could go home again, home again, home. Last of the true believers, you pack your things and go back home, you could go home again, home again, where I do take my rest at night. Oh, and I will be the last of the true believers. The truth is, it's hard to live, because this wintertime sure looks cold to me. I come on up around the bend. Last of the true believers, if you're weary all alone,